Well, Connect Summit County, in partnership with the Park City School District, is hosting a free lunch and learn with Randy Silverman. She's co-founder and CEO of the Youth Mental Health Project. The title is Talked No, Not Letting Go, Hope and Empowerment for Families with Children Struggling with Mental Health Issues. She joins me now in the studio. Good morning, Randy.
Good morning. Me.
To get you on that right mic there.
Oh, Ben. You got me now?
Yeah.
Thanks for having me.
So the talk is today, October 16th, 11:30 to 1, in the community room of the Park City Library. I was mistaken there earlier. So tell us just a little bit about the Youth Mental Project and why you started it.
Well, actually, I wrote and produced a film called No Letting Go, which played here. Connect brought the film in a couple of years ago for a screening, and it tells the story of my own family as we struggled when my middle son was very young and was diagnosed with anxiety, depression, and bipolar disorder. And that film has received over 20 international film festival awards. And as a result of that, I realized that we are really at a turning point where we're ready to have conversations about our children's mental health. And so I founded the Youth Mental Health Project to go out into the world and do my best to educate, empower, and support families and communities in their understanding of the importance of caring for their children's mental health. And so today, Summit, Connect Summit County and the Park City School District is bringing me in for this free event for the open to the community starting at 11:30. And we will really dive in deep to what the, to talking about these issues, about how to care for our children, how to tell the difference when it's a sign of concern, something they should be concerned about versus a typical developmental behavior or emotion.
Yeah. Mental health, it just is so expansive.
Yep.
So it includes just
everything.
Everything.
So people are very confused about what is mental health. Oh, so if I don't have a mental illness, then I must be well, for instance. It's a common misperception. Really, what I try to teach is that mental health lies on a continuum and it's ever evolving and changing. And we're born with it, just like we're born with our physical health. So if we could understand at very early ages how to care for and understand children's behaviors and emotions and thoughts, the way we understand that if they have a fever, we should take them to the doctor, and we could treat mental health concerns the same way we treat physical health concerns, then we could maybe get at this issue of mental illness earlier. And early intervention and prevention is possible, but it's not possible if we don't even understand what mental health is.
Right. And like you say, it's a continuum. I mean, and that's for all of us.
Everybody.
Know? Right. I mean, we're up and down all
exactly.
the time.
We all go through something at some point in our lives.
Right. So at what point then is it
How do you know?
Illness?
Well, that's a really good question. And that's part of my workshop today. As a matter of fact, what I'll tell you briefly, the overview is that what you want to look at for anybody is functioning. Are you able to function in the three major spheres of life? There's the school academic work sphere, there's the social sphere, and then there is the family at home daily living sphere of life. And if in any one of those areas you're really not able to function, so for a child who cannot go to school, for instance, you're not functioning if you can't get there, right? Or a child that comes home and falls apart and cannot interact well with a family. That's not functioning. And so you look at how does that child function in that sphere and how impaired is that? And I go through that in a deeper degree in the workshop. So if we look at it that way, just like our physical health, are you able to get out of bed? Right? Is it a cold that you can just power through, or do you need to be hospitalized because you're not functioning? And I think again, those comparisons are really helpful to people.
And can we use your son's story as an example here? I mean, what was it that you saw that it was like something's not right here?
Well, it's interesting. I think that there were very early warning signs starting when he was a toddler, but I didn't know. I didn't know that a child from a happy family, I didn't know a child like mine who was loved and lived in a nice neighborhood, that a child like that could struggle with anxiety or depression for no apparent reason. I didn't know that. And so in retrospect, I can say there were signs and symptoms when he was incredibly young. But what happened was in about third grade, he got to the point where he just hated school so much that getting him there every day was torture, to the point where no matter what I did, I couldn't get him there. It's a term that I now know is called school refusal. And he was 8, 9 years old, and nothing I did worked, and he fell into a very serious depression. So that's an example of, well, that's not normal, right? And I don't like to use normal. I don't like to use that term. It's more typical. A 9-year-old shouldn't feel so bad inside that he can't leave the house and go to school. And so I knew that wasn't proper functioning, right? So that's an example of when something's getting serious, right?
And then how do you even know what to do? I mean, that's a
huge problem, right? That if you are concerned, I would say to any parent who asks me, if you thought your child had a broken arm, would you go get help? Now, you're lucky here in Park City. I met people from the school system last night who are very interested in this topic and supporting children. And Connect Summit County does a wonderful job. I would go to your teachers, your school counselors, your pediatrician, and seek out the mental health services that are available. They're not as obvious as pediatricians. You have to look for them, but they are there if you look. I met two amazing psychiatrists last night who are in Park City. So they're here, but you have to look. And I would just say, if there's anything that you're concerned about, don't hesitate. There's no shame. And there shouldn't be any shame.
And that's, I think, a big part of yes. all of this. Again, we talk about it every time we talk about mental illness, and that is the stigma. But like you say, it's like if somebody's got diabetes or a broken arm, I mean, we don't think twice about
that's
that.
That's right. Yeah.
So what's the conversation over that? It's like...
Well, I think it's understanding it in that context and changing the narrative of how we talk about mental health and mental illness. We're starting to see a turn when it comes to adults. You know, famous people are coming out to say they've struggled with depression or bipolar disorder or anxiety, and we're starting to see a shift. What we're not seeing is a shift in how we talk about children. And again, it gets back to, as parents, we feel like failures, and that's just not true, but it's this perception we have in our culture.
Well, and it's just our culture itself. I mean, yep. You come in, how are you doing? I'm doing great. I mean, what else are you supposed to say? You can't say, no, I'm having the worst day of my life.
But you can. I go over, and here's what's interesting. When I started speaking out, which was before I made the film No Letting Go, the more I told people, the more my world opened up. And the more people started coming out of the woodwork saying, me too, my son too, my cousin, my brother. And my world changed for the better. And then when I found other parents like me, and there are millions of them, that's when I was able to gather the resources and gather the information and teach myself what I needed to know. Parents need to be empowered and supported and educated in order to know what to do. And you can't get help for a problem that you don't know exists. So we need to empower our parents. And so that's part of my message and part of what I try to do in my workshops. And that's really the mission of the Youth Mental Health Project.
Yeah. And I back to this whole cultural thing, though. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's niceties that we yeah. are among each other. And that's what children see. And,
right.
And
we don't model. Hmm. Yeah. We have to model. I decided when I understood that my child was struggling with a serious mental illness. He was suicidal at the age of 9. I was not going to allow him to grow up feeling ashamed of having an illness it wasn't his fault he had. And so I treated it like I would any other physical condition. I went out there and I engaged and I became informed and I searched for the best help and medications. And then I started speaking out because I wanted him to see I wasn't ashamed. And that's when things started to get better for all of us. So I encourage everybody. It's not that you have to be a Debbie Downer. Oh, I'm feeling so depressed. It's that, listen, I struggle with depression, and that's the way it is. And sometimes I have bad days, and sometimes I have good days. And there should be no shame in saying that. I don't think people with diabetes walk around announcing they have diabetes, but they're not ashamed to say, look, I can't do this, that, or the other thing because I'm having an issue with a condition that I am managing.
So again, you're going to be at the community room. That's the third floor of the Park City Library, 11:30 to 1. You'll have a presentation, I'm guessing, and then what, allow some time for Q&A?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I try to engage as much as I can. And it's a free event that connects Summit County, and the school district has brought me in for. And everyone is welcome. And I think it'll be really powerful.
Any idea if it's going to be video recorded?
They are recording it, and I believe Connect Summit County ultimately will hopefully get it up on their website. But there's nothing like being in the room, right?
Sure.
So those of you who can come on out. It'll be a great conversation.
And then the film itself, No Letting Go. I misspoke. I thought I made a typo. I didn't.
That's okay.
No Letting Go, Hope and Empowerment for Families with Children Struggling with Mental Health Issues. Is that somewhere that people can watch?
Yes. Yes, it is on Amazon. So you just have to Google No Letting Go. So it can be seen that way. I'm actually screening in Salt Lake City tomorrow at the Critical Issues Facing Children and Adolescents Conference. And we did screen here at the library 2 years ago. So if you get in touch with Connect Summit County, they can help you find access to it as well. But it's out there. Just Google it.
Okay. Thanks for being here, Randy.
Thank you for having me.
8:22 now. Good morning. Well, the Park City Board of Education meeting in a regular session tomorrow starting at 4 o'clock in the studio. I have the superintendent of schools, Amber Conley. Good morning.
Good morning.
So the agenda has an update on special ed resulting from the audit that was done last year by the Utah Board of Education. Some standout criticisms are that teachers express feeling bullied by parents. What can you tell us about that issue?
You know, I'll go back to the complete overview of the special education review. It was a team brought in that consisted of special education teachers from the state, an attorney, a special education attorney, and the special education director from the state office. And they did focus groups both with parents, with our staff, with our paraprofessionals, and with students. And so there were highlights of, you know, what are those things that you feel need to change? And I think that that's one thing that we continue to work through and is the communication, and that's two-way communication, right? So if you go back to the district, you know, what are those things that parents need as far as information, and what do we need from parents? And I would also say when we're dealing with, I'm going to say special education students, and their needs are so different, and the spectrum of what their needs are, it becomes very emotional. And so I think that, you know, when you're in teacher college, there's some things that you're not taught. And some of those things are often, how do you deal with upset parents? And so that's one of the things that we've been working on. And I mean, you just heard Randy Silverman talk about the school district and the support systems that we're putting in place. And one of the reasons that we've put more support in place, like our counselors, like our social worker counselors, is to be able to be a bridge for our classroom teachers, our students, and the parents.
Yeah, and we've also heard from parents saying that there isn't follow-through from year to year. They need more time with teachers. They need more meaningful collaboration with teachers. They want more involvement with their children's education. So are we making steps in that direction?
You know, I think that's some of the exciting work that I get really excited about, and that's putting in systematic change. And we all know change is hard. But systematically looking at not only what we're doing and defining what we're doing, putting in systems that follow our students year by year, also putting in intentional transitions. So when a child moves from preschool to kindergarten, having the team come together and say, who is this child? What do we know about this child? And then going from fifth grade to sixth grade, those teams pulling together with our fifth grade team and our sixth grade team. And I'm even going to say with some of our special education students that have possibly behavior disabilities, or we know that there is a weakness around transitions, we do it year to year.
So how many kids are we talking about district-wide that would be in the special ed program?
Right. So it varies. Right now, it goes anywhere from about 8 to 10%. In the nation, we have about a 13%. But what we're seeing is across the nation, the number of students being staffed into special education is getting up to 20% in some districts. So it's really not only changing, you know, what we're doing here in Park City, but it's changing the face of education.
Yeah. And are the student-teacher ratios different for special ed than they are for a regular classroom?
Well, that's kind of a loaded question. So special education really is defined as an individual education plan. And so it gets into the individualization of that child. So, for instance, I can use my own son. He's in special education. And he has specific minutes for his disability around reading, writing, and math. And so, yes, he does have the core curriculum with his teacher, but then he gets an additional support, so a tier two, tier three, with a special education teacher that specializes specifically in his disability.
So is that done in the classroom or?
It's typically done outside the classroom and in a different area, in a different classroom. So the special education teachers have their, and we call it, you know, have their own classrooms. And we, you know, we have speech, we have occupational therapy, and we have counseling that could be part of their individual education plan.
Uh-huh. But the idea is to keep special ed students in
always,
the classroom.
Right. So we're definitely the inclusion model, and I'm a huge proponent of that. But again, looking at their educational plan, being able to provide that tier two and that tier three, meaning that extra dose, that extra intervention for education.
And some parents have said they want their kids to have access to the Learning Center, now known as the Learning Academy. Has that process changed?
You know, it has. I'm going to say that there was in anything, you have to look at the truth that there's somewhere in between, right? And so I think that maybe the confusion had been with the Learning Center was the process in which students are chosen to go to the Learning Center. So we do have special education students at the Learning Center. We are also, and you're very aware of this, we're changing what the Learning Center is, and it's becoming, it's now the Learning Academy, and looking at a blended model approach that has a heavy emphasis on mentoring. So having students build those relationships with teachers, having rigorous curriculum, and then there's definitely a college and career portion of that.
Yeah. Talk to us a little bit about how a parent advocates for their special needs child.
Well, I can tell you, first of all, is to build relationships with the teacher, with the principal, and other parents that have children with special education needs. I would say that that's one of the best places. And you know, I would say that if there's still a feeling that my child, your child, is not getting what they need, I always have an open door. I have an email that we can help provide support. And I think one of the great things living in Park City is there's an idea that education is a shared responsibility. And so if we're having struggles of being able to provide the support for the family, we can make a phone call to so many of our community programs to provide that extra support for families.
Again, that's just a 15-minute conversation, really. Also, another 15-minute update with regard to the strategic planning. Last week, the board had a follow-up to an earlier meeting where the board had asked the public for input. It seemed we had 15 to 20 parents, a few teachers, school principals, no students or Latino population themselves. So there had been some sentiment that we have a good process, but we're missing students, teachers, and the Hispanic population.
Yep. So the board specifically discussed this last week on how to take the information that they've now gathered for the last couple of years, in addition to the evening on October 6th, and then do some individual breakout sessions. So specifically just for educators and staff, another one just for principals, working with our Latino outreach coordinator, Eric Escoval, being able to tap into our Latino community and their schedule so we can ensure their voice is heard. And in addition, once they do those individual breakout sessions, then coming back together with the community at large and saying, here's what we have found out. Let's talk further.
Okay. So what is the update then for tomorrow's meeting?
So what they're going to be, they'll solidify the dates. They did discuss dates. They'll also talk next steps when it comes to how does the strategic plan work into the district learning plan. We all know that we have a district learning plan, which is our educational roadmap. And then also, how does that work into our master planning? So, you know, what does our class sizes look like? What are our facilities going to look like? So they're starting to bridge, here's our values. Now, how's it going to affect our entire school system?
All right. And then the year of safe and healthy, there's also an update on that. What can we expect to hear there?
Right. So each board meeting, you're going to see this topic, the year of safe and healthy. So just some updates. It's fairly heavy, this agenda item, with law enforcement and fire and how we're working with our first responders. So we have a SWAT exercise, just a reminder to the community that tomorrow, if you see lots of emergency response vehicles at the high school tomorrow at 3 o'clock, don't worry. It's an exercise. So they'll be using our facility for the that evening. We have a tabletop active shooter. And so what that is we have a facilitator coming in December saying, here's the scenario. And we sit around a very large table with first responders, with fire, sheriff, PD, and we walk through the scenario together. We were given mass casualty bags. So after the Boston Marathon incident, the push was to have mass casualty bags in public institutions. We had these donated very generously from a community member, and so we have law enforcement training our first responder teams in our schools how to use these. And then finally is a teen parent course that is available through community ed. We all know that raising teenagers can be interesting at best, and so we've put together a course that the teens and the parents can attend.
All right. You also have the board has to make a decision with regard to the budget. What's that decision that they're being asked to make?
So right now, it's somewhat of a decision. What we're doing is looking at our enrollment, looking at projected what we know we're getting in from our property tax. And we are asking the board to adopt a timeline that's been different over the last, I'm going to probably say, 8 years. We're asking them to look at the timeline and bump it up about 2 months, because we've heard loud and clear we need to be able to recruit our teachers earlier. And so we're asking our board to be able to have that tentative budget set by April. So it backtracks about 2 months of our process. So we're starting right now.
Okay. Amber, anything else you wanted to mention?
No, just again, you already heard from our lunch and learn at the Park City Library this morning and afternoon, 11:30 to 1. We're thrilled to have Randy Silverman in our district.
Great. Amber, thanks. Okay. Superintendent of Park City Schools, Amber Conley. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. It's 8:33. KPCW News Time, 8:35. Good morning. Well, a lot of excitement at last week's Park City Council meeting. In the studio to tell us why, from the City Sustainability Department, I have Luke Carton and Celia Peterson. Good morning.
Good morning.
So what was the news out of last week's council meeting?
So the big piece was the council unanimously supported a net zero building standard for all city-built facilities moving forward. And what that means, to de-technify it, is we're going to try to make the buildings as efficient as they possibly can and then try to produce all of their energy needs on site. Now everyone says, well, that's interesting and that side of it. But it's also the first in the nation, if not kind of first in the world, for a municipality to set this level of goal. It really focuses on energy efficiency, siting the building correctly. And then we gave three different pathways of how to get to this net zero goal. And net zero is just, you look at the annual energy use, and we want to try to produce all of that on site as well.
So what are we building? Are we just talking about the affordable units that we're doing?
This is everything, Leslie. So there's only one small exemption, and that is for our water process equipment, which is a fancy way to say it's just our large pumps that we can never put enough renewables on site, but they already have a procurement process to make sure they buy the most energy efficient pumps, and they also have the water efficiency surcharge as well. So this will be, we've actually started looking at it. Some folks have seen glimpses of it for the Brewpub Park Community Center, but yeah, moving forward, we're going to try to make the buildings as efficient as they can, and then also add on some on-site renewables to produce everything. So our goal is to everything that's kind of bigger than a streetlight, we're going to try to produce on-site energy for.
Okay, and so what would that look like? Basically solar panels, right? We're not going to have windmills at these locations.
Yeah, correct. And I think the key, though, and I keep hammering it hard, is it's a long-term vision. So the city spends just around $2 million a year in energy costs. About 60% of that's electricity. 25-ish percent is fuels like diesel and gasoline. The last remainder is natural gas, and those fluctuate depending on what's happening with the prices. So our goal is to truthfully, you know, everyone knows utility costs are not going to go down. So what we do is we build the building as efficient as we can, make sure we maximize the building envelope, right size everything in it. And then, yeah, solar will be the kind of the best bet. We'll look at some other options out there. There's always some crazy funky things coming around the corner. But yeah, solar seems to make the most sense for up here.
Okay. So how is this different than the goals of being net zero by 2022? Celia, you want to take
that
one?
So this is a piece. This is one way that we're going to reach the goal. So this is looking at our buildings and facilities and just decreasing the amount of energy and therefore carbon emissions that are coming from running those buildings.
Yeah, about 40% of our city's operation footprint is facilities.
All right. So I had heard that you were getting calls from Copenhagen. What are they asking?
Yeah, so I'm actually heading out to it's called the Urban Sustainability Directors Network. It's folks with my role all over the world. Getting together next week for a conference, and I'm actually speaking on 100% renewable and working with utilities. But there's a subgroup called the Carbon Neutral Cities Alliance that we've been talking with. And there's a couple cities, international cities, that were really interested in to see what we just passed because no one's ever tried this before. We were actually emailing with someone from Somerset, Mass., I believe.
Somerville, Mass.
So it's, like I said, it's ambitious. We were very explicitly clear with council that this is a true step of leadership. And so I'm going to be talking to a lot of these international cities about the pathways to get there that we're looking at for the net zero building piece.
So is this the conference in San Diego?
Correct. Yeah. So I'm heading out to San Diego, and it's a total geek fest of urban sustainability folks. It's talking about everything from urban planning, social justice, energy, and those pieces with folks who hold my role. So there's about 1,500 folks around the world that have my position, a municipal sustainability person. So it's just the annual get together where we actually get to learn from each other and also learn from some of the experts in the field.
So I guess I'm surprised to hear that Park City is the first in the world to put in a net zero building standard.
Yeah, it's as I jokingly say, the best code you can write is written by someone else, and you just change the words. And a couple of folks have dabbled with it, but no one's really dove in yet. So that was the goal for us, was to say, hey, council was very interested in it. They were pushing for it. You could hear the push in a lot of the city projects that were coming up. So we said, hey, we're going to do it. And the other key piece that folks always raise their eyebrows about is, well, this is going to cost a lot more. And Celia, you want to cover that, the cost piece?
How much is it going to cost, right?
Yeah, so, I mean, every project is different, of course. But if we're focusing on energy efficiency and right-sizing things, then that helps to keep the cost down. But in all of the literature that I looked through, which was quite a bit, for new builds, it's anywhere from 5 to 12% is the cost increase. So it's not that much, and then that can be recouped over the years, as you're saving energy.
Right. So when do we do this then with our general plan and our development code for all development in Park City? Because I mean, that would be really easy to do, is to, you know, add that new homes need to be wired for solar energy.
Our hope, so there's a couple different things. We have a couple tools in our toolbox and a few major tools missing. Our hope that the Utah legislature would help us enact that. But we do have some pieces that we could look at to kind of help push folks in that direction in a good way of just saying, hey, if you're building a house, let's make sure we put in the conduit for not only solar panels, but also an electric car and potentially energy storage. I mean, we're talking conduit, so we're not increasing the cost of everything. To mandate it, you know, a lot of folks say, well, Colorado and Aspen, they mandate it through their rent program. We don't have that power as a municipality. We're looking at things called it's stretch code. So there's different incentives. If you meet a certain threshold, there's different incentives you can give. We're trying to get creative because we don't have the full set of tools that other cities have. But our thought is we'll figure it out, and there's definitely a hunger in this community to do that.
Well, and you should say it is going to make – you will have to work with the state legislature because you'll be shot down that quick by the – real estate lobby, right?
Yeah, well, the interesting thing is that Utah's under more change than I think people will understand. I'm not saying that we're going to be a crazy pot-smoking state in a year, but I think the flip side of that is that it ties back to some of the state values of responsibility and just that overall, you know, the individual rights. And so there's a lot of potential pieces out there. It's been really interesting to see some of the allies coming together for some of the renewable pieces. So our hope is that, you know, that'll kind of start gaining some momentum and help drive the state to change.
Okay. It was also mentioned last week at the council meeting that you're working with Rocky Mountain Power for what's called an EPSA, an Engineering Performance Service Contract. What is this?
An EPSA. Yep. So what it is for our 2022 goal, so the city operations goal, we're going to be coming in front of council in a few weeks with this engineering agreement. And what the agreement does is it lays out a path. It takes 430 days to complete. But during that time, it's sizing how much renewables we would need for our city operations. And that's actually a pretty hard number to tie down right now because we're electrifying our bus fleet. We've got, you know, we've got a lot of big pieces moving around. So as we go through that process, it'll say, all right, you need X amount of renewables and here's some potential sites. After that study is completed, then we switch into something called a retail services agreement. And that is literally shovel in the ground. We're building this solar farm or this wind farm or this solar and wind farm at these locations. And when we go through the EPSA, we'll have some options. We can say, all right, what's the cost benefit analysis of siting something in Summit County? What makes sense for us to put it in, say, Carbon County or Millard County, or where they've suffered from huge job losses for the past 8 years. So it's just a question of, you know, as we work through this, it's really truly the study of these are the renewables that will come online. And also this is how PacifiCorp, Rocky Mountain Power's parent company, will have to adjust their operations. So it's not just, hey, we're going to slap some panels up and give ourselves a pat on the back. It is changing around the way that the utility manages their fossil fuel resources.
Right. Now, is this going to be like what we saw with their solar subscriber farm?
No, this is different. So this is, you can view it as we will, so the subscriber solar piece, Rocky Mountain Power owned the generation and the transmission. So they own the kind of the part that makes the electricity and how to get it to you. This is really looking at the how do they get it to you piece. So there's a lot of transmission pieces and that side of it. And then what we'll do is we'll issue a joint RFP for these renewable resources that we need. In theory, Rocky Mountain Power could bid on it, but there's a lot of third parties that will bid on it as well. So a third party crew will go out and actually build a resource for us. And then we figure out how to get it through the transmission to us for our city operations.
So are we talking about having our own utility possibly? Is that the road to that?
I wouldn't say our own utility. I would say our own dedicated generation for our city operations. So this is you can view us as the city as a customer in this one. For the 2032 one, you can view the city as a community. In the 2032 piece, where we're community wide, we're still working on how to get there. So that door is still fairly wide open. This EPSA, this 2022 piece, the nice thing is the regulatory path already exists. So we're going down that to cover the city operations.
Okay. And real quick, when you mentioned we'll never be able to do it for our water pumping operations, but weren't we working with a hydroelectric something plant to make that happen?
Yeah, we're looking at it. The great thing is our water team, they're experts in pumping and energy use. So there is a couple of different identified areas for small hydro. That we're working into the plan. So as we say, hey, we're going to bring on this plant or this piece or do this system upgrade, we can start dropping in hydro to take advantage of gravity and water, free resource.
Okay. I'm going to leave it there, but we'll bring you back after your conference. That one might be interesting to hear some of the other things that you heard there.
Yeah, sounds great.
Okay, Luke, Celia, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
KPCW News Time, 8:47. October is Dyslexia Awareness Month, and through a new private public partnership, there will be more support for the school district struggling readers, including those with dyslexia. In the studio with details, I have the executive director of the Park City Education Foundation, Abby McNulty, along with Julie Hastings, the school district's curriculum specialist. Good morning, ladies.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Before we just talk about that partnership itself, maybe just for a bit of background, Abby, you have a personal story here, a child who's been diagnosed with dyslexia. So what have you learned about the struggling reader?
Yeah, that's a great question. So my daughter was actually identified last year as part of this pilot program at McPolin as a struggling reader, as at risk. And she was 5 at the time. And what I learned is a couple things. One, dyslexia is genetic. So I'm also dyslexic, and so is my sister and niece and nephew and my father. And I also learned that dyslexia is different for every kid. It's a spectrum. And for us, it presented with just really not wanting to go to school. Really sad, really frustrated, would act out at home. And when we dug into it more, you know, she really just struggled with reading. You know, it was like it was totally foreign to her. And so it was really stressful in the classroom. Hmm.
So we talk about the gifts of dyslexia, but at this age, when we're talking about five, it's more of a disability, no?
I mean, it totally depends on how you want to look at it. So my daughter is so social. She is dramatic. She acts things out, you know, but she struggles with reading. So and I think the other piece of it is I'm so grateful and thankful for this program. It was a partnership with the Ed Foundation, and I personally benefited because my daughter was identified as having a struggle reading at age five. And the early intervention is the most important piece. And so she's in first grade now, and she is doing great. So I feel, for me, you know, working in this role for 10 years, this has been the most eye-opening as a mother to see the difference that these kinds of programs can make on kids.
So, Julie, you were the one who led this program, pilot program at McPolin last year, huge undertaking just in terms of the training and time. It was done with the help of the Hall Family Fund, also the school district and
the Ed Foundation, and PC Reads.
PC Reads, yeah. Mm-hmm. So what did you find out in this pilot program?
Well, we found out that when you give teachers the training and the time and a clear goal with all of the resources and focus on it and create a lot of dialogue around it and support them throughout the whole year, it is possible to do. We think oftentimes that, oh, well, it's a research-based program. We can do this, no problem. But teachers have a lot on their plate. They are constantly building that airplane while it's in flight. So we had to find out, we know this is research-based. We know this is a great idea. But is it realistic? Can teachers really do it? With the time in the day and everything they have going on.
So can they?
Yes. We did. We found out that with the clear implementation plan and following through with it, the McPolin teachers were the guinea pigs, and they figured out all of the kinks. And then at the end of last year, they brought all of the other kinder, first, and second grade teachers together and shared their insight and let them know this is really a great thing for all students. And it also explains a lot more about why students struggle. And when you really can zone in on what that difficulty is and why the student is struggling, now teachers can better problem solve around that. And so when the McPolin teachers shared that with the other teachers in the district, it really helped provide the understanding of why we were getting into this.
Yeah. So what's changed, though, over the last few years? Because I can remember the women of PC Reads having to start their own nonprofit because they couldn't get the help they thought their kids deserved through the school district.
Well, I think that speaks to the advocacy of PC Reads. They brought the halls and the program to the attention of Park City School District and created this really amazing partnership. And the Foundation's program is a reading curriculum that supports all kids, but it's multisensory so that if you have a struggling reader or a potentially dyslexic child, it will also work, you know, it also reaches them in terms of reading. Because when you're dyslexic, you need to learn, you learn differently. You don't, the reading pathways in your brain are different. And so you have to have this multisensory approach where you're hearing, seeing, touching, feeling the language and the letters.
So moving forward, what's the dyslexia initiative for 2017-18?
That's this school year. Mm-hmm. The program, the pilot rolled out from McPolin to all four elementary schools, and PC Reads, in addition, does advocacy training and awareness training of dyslexia to all the schools. And in addition, the Hall Fund is paying for teachers to receive Orton-Gillingham trainings, teachers in the elementary school.
All right. So is it – because it used to be that it would cost parents thousands of dollars to have their student – tested for dyslexia. We're doing that now within the classrooms?
Well, what this initiative has done has given us early indicators and screeners that we can use in the classroom and that teachers commonly use now that raise those red flags. So just like Abby was saying with her daughter, those red flags were raised in the classroom with the teacher by using the systematic approach that we have. And so currently, that is the goal, is to raise those red flags within the classroom and try to support the students with the learning style that they need so that then maybe there is no reason to do further testing.
Yeah, and I think research shows that we could have as many as 900 students in the district. And when we talk, is it just students that are dyslexic or students with that are struggling readers? I mean, is there a difference?
Yeah, I mean, I'll speak just as a parent. So my daughter, we're dyslexic in my family, but my daughter will be considered an at-risk reader, not necessarily dyslexic at this point in time, per her diagnosis. So does this program help her? 100%. Is it intended for, to support dyslexic students and at-risk students? I think yes is the answer. I think when your kid has a reading disability, it's a constant journey. So this year, she's doing great. As the curriculum and the material gets more difficult, it's not something that I will, forget about. We consistently, take the pulse and see how she's doing and whether she needs more interventions and things like that. So it's a complicated answer because no one child is the same.
And there are different approaches to teaching reading. So there are a few different theories, and so it depends on which student, which strategy students do best with.
Sure. How much, how long has the Hall Family Fund agreed to support this?
Well, the costs of this program are largely upfront costs, buying all the materials. And so they purchased the materials for K through 2 for the school district. And the school district did partner with some finances as well. And Julie is in charge of this program as a district administrator. So the district is also putting in significant resources too. Future costs of the program.
Well, next year, we would roll it up to third grade in the other buildings as well. So there would be training costs and material costs then. And then after that, it's more of the sustainability costs. And that is a big focus with this as well, is not only how do we do this year and next year, but how do we sustain this in the school district and keep it going for a long time and make it a part of what we do and who we are.
Great. I need to leave it there. Ladies, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you.
KPCW News Time now, 8:55. It's the local news hour on KPCW. KPCW News Time now, 8:56. Good morning. In the studio with an update from Basin Recreation District Director Brian Hatton. Good morning, Brian.
Good morning.
Hey, let's just talk real quickly about, because we were talking about refinancing and refunding some bonds for open space and trails and such. But just a real quick background, the district was formed when we saw a lot of residential growth exploding in the Snyderville Basin, recreation amenities to serve that growth. And the district was formed, and you receive funding now, right, for those living within the Snyderville Basin, including
Correct.
Promontory.
Yes.
How much do you guys get every year?
We get about $3.5 million a year. That's, our main source of revenue for our operation. So it's definitely helps us along as we get through.
Okay. And with that, then you run all of the facilities and
right.
then plan for new facilities as well?
Exactly. This past budget, well, we're going through our budget season now. We operate of our own revenues is about 32%. The rest is supported from the property tax. So, and that's nationwide. That's pretty much average what we see. We use that for our operations and those types of things. But then when we get to bigger facilities and those, that's where we have to reach out to bond with the community.
Okay. And we have bonded, a handful of times, yeah?
About that. I was trying to add it up. I think it was 4 total since inception. I think there was a 98, an 04, an 11 or a 10, and a 14.
All right. And some of those paid off at this point? Or
yes. The first two have been paid off. We still have funds from the 11 and from the 14 bond.
All right. And then what you're asking the board is to refund or refinance that 2010 bond?
Yes, that's correct.
To do what?
Just to help. We will actually gain about $1.5 million that will save the taxpayers on that refinance. So, we thought that was a pretty substantial amount, and the organization that we work with, they recommended it because of the savings that was out there at the time.
Okay. So that's just less money that taxpayers have to pay.
Exactly. Yep.
Great. All right. Let's talk quickly about a couple of events coming up. October 25th, you've got the Run Amok Cleanup.
Run Amok Cleanup. Always fun to go out there. And I mean, as much as we love our dogs, we aren't as diligent picking up after our dogs. So hopefully with this day on the 25th, between 10 and 12, we'll have buckets, we'll have shovels, we'll have everything they need. Just come out, bring your dog, and walk around and just pick up some of the leftovers that the dogs have left behind.
Okay, because you know that your dog probably did do that.
Yes.
If you use the park, please show up.
Exactly.
Also, coming up October 28th, the Celebrate the Spirits Trick or Treat Run.
Yep, the Celebrate the Spirits is a fun run. It's I think it's about 6 years now. Great opportunity for kids to not realize they're running because they're going from station to station where we have candy set up. So it's about a 5K, and it starts at the field house at about 11 a.m., I think, is the kickoff. And they just run down the trail along Swanner and back, and we'll have between 10 to 20 tables set up with different sponsors. So if you're a business out there and would like to sponsor a table, we'd love to have you. And just pass out candy or whatever. Some pass out healthy food, some use our candy. We supply the candy, a table. You just need a tent if you want to bring some type of a cover. But it's a great event. It's fun to see everyone dressed up in costumes, and it's not just kids. I mean, we have adults and kids of all ages out there, so it's fun to be involved with.
Okay, and then real quick, just an update. You're getting a new website redo, huh?
Yes, we're redoing our website and our registration system. So we sent out an email to 8,000 people last week letting them know, get the information you can because everyone has to re-enter all their information. So if they can get in ahead of time, so on November 1st, it's not as painful to either re-up a membership or re-register for a program when that time comes. So if they have a chance, do that, or just reach out to someone at Basin Recreation, our front desk. They can give you the link that can get you there if you didn't receive the email. But it would just help the operations for you and for us.
Okay. Brian, we'll see you next month.
All right.
Thanks.
Thank you.